From WBUR Boston, I'm Wade Goodwin in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In Reno, Nevada on Tuesday, Mitt Romney lashed into the Obama administration's conduct of foreign policy, and he laid out his vision.
I am an unapologetic believer in the greatness of America. I am not ashamed of American power.
Grief in Colorado, and the red-headed suspect appears in court. Here's Aurora Police Chief Daniel Oates.
If you think we're angry, we sure as hell are angry about what has happened to our city, what has happened to these wonderful people who live here.
The NCAA brings the hammer down on Penn State. Here's NCAA President Mark Emmert.
Football will never again be placed ahead of educating, nurturing, and protecting young people.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Bill McKenzie from the Dallas Morning News, Molly Ball from the Atlantic, and On Point news analyst Jack Beattie. You can join the conversation. What do you make of Romney's trip abroad? Did the punishment for Penn State football fit the crime? Are you gearing up to watch the Olympics? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us today from Dallas is Bill McKenzie. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist for the Dallas Morning News. Bill, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you, Wade.
With us today from Washington is Molly Ball, who covers politics for the Atlantic. Molly, it's a pleasure.
Hi, Wade.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beattie joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Wade, Bill, and Molly.
Guys, Governor Romney quickly embarked upon his first campaign trip abroad, stopping in London, and quickly got off to a poor start. If I'm a Romney handler, I'm slapping my forehead thinking, Governor, why did you say that? This is what Romney said about London's Olympic Games.
You know, it's hard to know just how well it will turn out. There are a few things that were disconcerting. The stories about the private security firm not having enough people. The supposed strike of the immigration and customs officials, that obviously is not something which is encouraging.
That certainly earned Romney no gold medals with the British press, and Romney had to try to walk his comments back. Bill, what do you think's going on?
Well, I think you're right. If you're a Romney handler, you would be slapping your head about that. You know, as I listened to that, I kind of thought, well, I wonder if this is Romney, the guy who is the 2002 Salt Lake organizer, speaking, you know, more literally than he should have about, well, you know, you don't know how these things are going to unfold. And technically, he's correct. But no, I don't think you're going to want that to be your soundbite coming out of your first foreign stop, and particularly when you're right there in the middle of the Olympics. That isn't what you really want to have happen.
Molly, I kind of thought that he might have been kind of patting himself mildly on the back. What did you think?
That seemed to be the interpretation of the British as well. You had David Cameron, the Prime Minister, saying in response to Romney's comments, well, it's easy to throw the Olympics in the middle of nowhere, which seemed to be sort of a reference to Salt Lake City and maybe Romney having an easier task. Look, a lot of people agree with what Romney said. There are a lot of doubts about London's preparation for the Olympics. But beyond even the rules of diplomacy, it's just sort of the basic rules of manners that you don't go into somebody's house and insult them. And, you know, Romney's always had this sort of penchant for sticking his foot in it. But that's just a gaffe when you do it on the campaign trail. When you do it internationally, it becomes an international incident. The stakes are a little bit higher.
Jack, it really doesn't seem like Romney at all, who comes across as a very friendly person. Your thoughts?
Well, there's an unbeatable tweet from a columnist, Janice Turner, for the London Times. She goes, "So Mitt Romney disses our Olympics. We're the special relationship, the easy-peasy bit of U.S. foreign relations. How will he deal with China?" Well, you know, in a way, this is a Kinsleyan moment. Michael Kinsley years ago said, "A gaffe is when a politician tells the truth." and it's inconvenient. And he did tell the truth. Of course, it's been disconcerting to anybody, but as Molly said, most inopportunely timed. You know, some people defend Governor Romney's awkwardness as a sign of his sincerity. He's not your polished politician. He's not your smooth operator. I saw this myself up in New Hampshire. There was an event here. I went to it, and I was speaking to a woman who was there, and she said, "You know, I've never come out for a candidate before. 20 years, I'm coming out now for Mitt Romney." Romney comes around, shakes hands. I shook his hand, and I said, Governor, this woman has lived here for 25 years. You're the first candidate she's ever come out for. And instead of saying, oh, gee, that's great, he looked at us and he said, you two together? I mean, it was so awkward. And then Mrs. Romney came along, and she was sweetness and light. Oh, thank you for coming out. It's flattering to my husband and so on. And you just saw the guy is an awkward politician.
Well, today he let slip that he met with Sir John Sawyers, head of the MI6, which is the British equivalent of the CIA. This was a secret meeting, but whoops, not anymore. What's going on here? Is the governor having trouble acting presidential, i.e. controlling his own tongue, Molly?
That certainly seems to be the case. And, you know, this is a trip that as Jack was just saying, it was explicitly scripted to be as easy as possible, right? You go to Britain, where we have a special relationship, where there's a conservative government in power, where the Olympics are happening, which is an obvious opportunity for Romney to sort of look back at his experience and highlight a very good part of his resume. From here, he's going to go to Israel and then to Poland, two other places where obviously his campaign has seen an opportunity for him to look good without a lot of downside or without a lot of opportunity for bad things to happen. And yet, he seems to be finding a way, carving out opportunities to make these gaffes happen.
Carl is calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Carl, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much. Listen, I'm listening to Mitt Romney talk about foreign affairs all this past week. My father is a Vietnam veteran who donned the uniform of the United States Marine proudly, went over in Southeast Asia, and this draft dodger, Mitt Romney, speaking in front of veterans of foreign wars, and then is going to talk about the president and his administration having leaks, and then he go over in London and leak out that he's talked to the M6. To me, it's disturbing. I know a lot of people get a little chuckles out of how the Brits are hard on him. It's disturbing. This guy is out of touch. He's uppity. He just seems like everything is beneath him. And on top of that, like I said, my father's one of the fortunate ones that came back okay. He didn't come back an addict or anything like that. He raised me and my family well. And this guy was a draft dodger. I don't take him serious. I have a serious problem with
Carl, I think we get your point. Jack Beatty, any thoughts?
Well, I think that Governor Romney had an exemption for religious exemption. He was doing his I think in his draft vulnerable years, he was doing his missionary work in France, and I think that was a perfectly legitimate exemption taken by other people who were in that position, and then after that he was married at an early age. So I don't know that he's a draft dodger. I think that's pretty rough.
The governor then went to Nevada and spoke in front of the VFW, and he had a much better reception there.
We can't lead the world by hoping our enemies will hate us less. Ronald Reagan rallied America with peace through strength. American strength is the only guarantee of liberty. American strength turned the Cuban Missile around. American strength caused the collapse of the Soviet Union. American strength yanked Saddam Hussein out of his spider hole. With freedom as the cause, strength is the only sure defense.
In Reno, Nevada on Tuesday, then President Obama, in front of the same group, defended his foreign policy achievements in a speech to the annual convention of the VFW.
4 years ago, I made you a promise. I pledged to take the fight to our enemies and renew our leadership in the world. As president, that's what I've done. And as you reflect, as you reflect on recent years, as we look ahead to the challenges we face as a nation and the leadership that's required, you don't just have my words, you have my deeds.
It's not easy getting to the right of this president on foreign policy. Jimmy Carter, no sweat. Barack Obama, not so much. The president doubled down in Afghanistan. He organized air support to bring down Gaddafi. He sent Navy SEALs into Pakistan to kill Obama and sends killer drones into other nations' sovereign territory. But, you know, I think it's instinctive for Republicans to say they're tougher than the Democrats to try to get to the right of Democrats on foreign policy. Will it sell this time around, Bill?
Well, I think you're right. I mean, this election is not going to be one on foreign policy. And so while we're understandably talking about Romney's gaffe in London and talking about this speech, that really isn't going to be the central issue. It matters, but it's not central. What's central is the economy. And I think to some extent, Romney, he went out, he marked his position. I would hope Republicans, if they come back into power in the administration, would do more than just talk about America's strength and kind of blood and guts sort of things. I agree with you. I don't think that President Obama is very vulnerable on foreign policy. This week, the Wall Street Journal, New York, NBC News poll showed that on, I think, 7 out of 8 issues, the public kind of preferred Obama over Romney, and foreign policy was one of them. But where they truly didn't favor Obama was the economy.
This is On Point. I'm Wade Goodwin in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about a week in the news. We're talking with Bill McKenzie of the Dallas Morning News, Molly Ball, political reporter for The Atlantic, and our own Jack Beatty. Obama, I just saw a news flash that Obama is going to sign a new U.S.-Israeli security pact that's going to send more military equipment to Israel. This, of course, is expertly timed to steal Romney's thunder in Israel. Molly, is the Obama campaign running on all cylinders here?
It certainly seems to be. You see these suspiciously timed sort of coincidental actions that the administration is taking just as Romney happens to be overseas. And Romney has taken the sort of traditional vow of not criticizing the administration while on foreign shores. But there's no such compunction from the other side. The Obama campaign's been sitting there in Chicago firing shot after shot and very happy, very gleeful to see what he's going through over there.
Jack, I would think this is going to put Romney's vow to the test. I mean, if I get to Israel, I might have a few words.
Yes, yes. Governor Romney did have a few words at the VFW convention. He said that the administration was less than a good ally of Israel. But, of course, the defense minister there, Ehud Barak, has said, quote, he can hardly remember a better period, end quote, of U.S. support for Israel. And in general, you know, in that speech, it was really striking. I watched both speeches. And the president talked for 15 minutes listing the promises he had made on the national security and to veterans and the promises he had kept. And they went from killing bin Laden to hiring 200,000 veterans in the federal government. He got steady applause. Mr. Romney began speaking, and he gave that line that we quoted at the beginning where he said, "I am not ashamed of American power," and the House came down. They just cheered and cheered. And that ashamed of American power, and I don't apologize, goes right to his critique of Obama foreign policy, which is based on nothing. He titled his campaign book "No Apology: The Case for American Greatness," and in it he said that President Obama conducted an apology tour, and he named apologies that he'd said allegedly made in France, England, Turkey, Cairo, CIA, you name it. Fact checkers have found no scintilla of apology in anything the president has said. And they have not found anything in there even questioning American exceptionalism. Yes, the president at one point did say, "Brits no doubt believe in their exceptionalism," and then he went on to a paean to American exceptionalism. So Governor Romney titled his campaign book around a really kind of a fiction that the president has apologized for American power. He hasn't.
Jerry is calling from Cookeville, Tennessee. Jerry, welcome to the program.
Hi, Wade. I like the speech that Governor Romney gave, and I like the speech that the president gave. But when you talk about apologies, I remember the speech that the president gave in Cairo, the New Beginning speech, when he said it was his job as president to stop negative stereotyping of Islam wherever it is. And then he went on to say that about qualities of or equality of women's issues. And he said it's by no means simply an issue for Islam. In Turkey, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and Indonesia, we've seen Muslim-majority countries elect a woman to lead. Meanwhile, the struggle for women's equality continues in many aspects of American life. So he's making it sound like it's harder on women in America than what it is in those four Muslim countries that are oppressive regimes. And I just find it kind of amazing that people would say that how can I be polite about it? His foreign policy. Look what's happening with Russia and China. They won't come to bat for anything that we want. In fact, they're standing against us. We have the Muslim Brotherhood, another terrorist organization running Egypt, who's calling for the destruction of Israel. In fact, their spiritual leader, Yosef Kaladari, was calling. He said, Hitler was sent by Allah to exterminate the Jews.
No, Jerry, I take your point. Molly, it sounded a little bit like an apology to Jerry.
Well, I think the caller is right in that Obama did come in explicitly on a promise to take a more conciliatory and collaborative tone toward the rest of the world. This is in the wake of the George W. Bush administration, when a lot of liberals felt that Bush had been too swaggering, too cowboyish, too sort of go it alone in his interactions with the rest of the world, whether that was the Iraq War specifically or just the sort of stance he took. And in diplomacy, you know, tone does matter. The flip side of that, though, is that Romney's critique seems to be all tone. It seems to be all about just sort of how aggressive or how blustery can your rhetoric be toward the rest of the world. When you drill down into the substance of his policies, there isn't a lot of difference with what Obama has done. He has been very, very critical of the idea of having timetables for getting out of Afghanistan, for example, but then he proposes his own timetable, which is the same as Obama's. It involves getting troops out in 2014. And so, you know, in Israel, there's a lot of tough talk about how the administration has not been loyal enough to Israel. But the number one thing he says he would do differently is that he would go there. He would make a presidential visit, which Obama hasn't done. Well, that's basically a symbolic gesture. So I think the criticism of Romney has been that there's just not a lot of meat on the bones of this very sort of aggressive sounding foreign policy critique of the president.
Bill, it's been three tough weeks for Romney, surprisingly so in my opinion, because the economy is serving up softballs for him to hit out of the park. But because he won't release but 1 year of his tax returns, he's reacting instead of acting.
Well, I think if you take the broader view and you look what some of the polls are saying is, you know, last week we had the New York Times poll in, and Romney was, you know, he's within spitting distance of Obama. On the Wall Street Journal poll this week, as I'm doing this from memory here, I believe it was among highly engaged or interested voters, I believe it was Romney 48 and Obama 46. So he has a base there that is mobilized to go vote for him. And on, again, on the central issue in this race, economics, it's by far Romney is largely the candidate that voters say they want to handle these issues. I would say on the foreign policy speech, I think a point that kind of gets overlooked a little bit and is the fact that a strong economy is going to be very important to, you know, our role in the world. If I think what Romney really should be hitting Obama on is more of Obama's economic nationalism, this whole idea about you know, outsourcing and having Swiss bank accounts, whatever. Of course, I understand at one level that doesn't sell well, but we're in a global economy. And I think Romney has an opening here to go explain how he can be explain global capitalism and the global economy and how that's in the advantage of Americans and how that's so important to our role in the world. I think Obama is vulnerable on that front.
Yeah, but you know, but there's one problem there, Bill, and that is Governor Romney has taken a very, as you know, controversial position on China trade.
Yeah, one is,
and as John Boehner said, a very dangerous position, practically saying we're going to have a trade war with China. That's tough to fit into a narrative of, you know, the global economy. But I agree.
Well, That's one issue, and I agree it's a big issue. But I think overall, I don't think that international trade necessarily has been the strong suit of President Obama. I think they've done some things, and I want to congratulate them on that. But I think that Romney can make a much strong case that he would be expanding American markets abroad better than Obama has, and that he won't have an economic nationalism. In fact, he will have kind of an economic internationalism, if that's a phrase.
Molly, would you like to see the governor put more meat on his policy bones?
In all senses?
Yes.
Or just in this sense?
In all senses.
Yeah. This is something that a lot of Republicans have been critical of Romney about as well, that they feel like they haven't heard a lot of specifics from him. And when he has put out specific plans, they've been sort of incomplete. You know, he has an economic plan, but it doesn't balance the budget, for example. And the Romney campaign has sort of explicitly declined to be more specific because they feel like whatever they put out just becomes fodder for attacks from the other side. And there is a sense that, kind of as we've been talking about, the state of the economy is what's going to determine this election. How people feel about the economy is going to determine how people vote at the end of the day. And so in a very real sense, all of the rest of this stuff, the white papers, the gaffes, the criticisms here and there, is all sort of noise. And all he really needs to do is sort of keep his head down, stay the course as much as possible. And if the economy keeps doing what it's been doing, and we have new GDP numbers today that seem to substantiate that, then he's going to be in a good position sort of no matter what he does.
Bill, do you agree?
Yes, I would. Yes, I do. And Jack, you may remember we were together back in New Hampshire, and you had a great line that I thought, and I'm going to use it here whether you want to or not, is that what Romney should be doing is say, look, I've spent my career in business and I've made mistakes, but I have spent my career looking through the lens of American businesses, and I think I kind of know what they may need to rejuvenate. And I think he needs to keep speaking to the entrepreneurial class in America, which, for reasons that are kind of unclear to me, President Obama has never chosen to really speak to as much as, say, Bill Clinton did.
If the governor continues to insist that he's only going to release 1 year of his tax returns, is this something that he is vulnerable still? I mean, could it be worse? Will he survive it? What's your thoughts on that?
Well, I would point out that he's actually promised to release 2 years of his tax returns. He's released one already, and then he has applied for an extension on his tax year 2011 return, and he has said that he's going to put out the full return as soon as it's ready and has promised that that will be before the election. And so this issue is, even if it goes away right now, which I get the sense it is dying out a bit, I think the Romney campaign's calculation that it would eventually get overshadowed by the Olympics and then probably the vice presidential selection and then the conventions, that may in fact work out for them. But then there's this sort of ticking time bomb of this other tax return that they have promised they're going to release. So even if he doesn't ever give in to the demands for 5 years or 10 years or 20 years going all the way back, there is this other tax return. And we've seen in the one full year that he released already, there was plenty there for the opposition to pick out and haggle over and criticize, whether it was the Swiss bank account or the stuff in Bermuda and the Cayman Islands. So and let's make it clear, none of this is illegal. It all appears to be perfectly legitimate, but it becomes, again, the fodder for these attacks. And so it's inevitably going to come up again as long as he keeps that promise to release another year.
Jack, I've talked with some Democratic consultants who have vowed that they are going to continue to ask the governor what he's hiding unless he releases years of his tax returns, and that they think that's going to be a big winner for them.
I just don't know. I mean, I just can't see anything like that trumping the economy. And you know, I'm struck by the flack that Romney is taking from Republicans. I'm up to 15 different Republicans or conservative columnists who said, Mitt, you've got to come out. You've got to tell us. The presumption is you're hiding something, and that gets to be a problem. You know, when you hear it from your own side, and this is going to come up with the vice president, because typically, I mean, when Mitt Romney was applying for the vice presidency, that nomination with John McCain, he gave out 20 years of returns. And they're going to get lots of returns from their vice presidential nominee. And reporters are going to say, well, Governor Romney, you looked at 10 years of Tim Pawlenty or whoever it is, his taxes. Can't we see 10 years of yours? So we haven't heard the last of it.
Let's take a call from John. He's calling from Irwin, Pennsylvania. John, welcome to the show.
He's saying that it's his fault, but yet all the tax breaks we gave to the 1% was to create jobs and increase and improve the economy. Well, we did that, and what was the outcome? We lost all those jobs. People lost their homes. They lost mortgages. And now we want to give it to them again because they're saying, well, they're the job creators. Well, how's Romney supposed to answer that? He's saying that if we do that, they will improve the jobs and get jobs going and improve the economy, but yet we already did it.
Okay, thank you, John. Let's take another caller. Ron is calling from Rensselaer Falls, New York. Ron, welcome to the show.
Hi, Wade. Yeah, earlier on the campaign trail, Mitt Romney talked about keeping Americans strong, and one of the things he wanted to do was increase the military by adding 100,000 enlisted personnel and expanding their naval fleet. And that kind of, you know, talk scares me because the United States spends more on its military than all the nations combined. We're in debt. Our military has already been beat up in serving overseas, and yet he wants to double down and feels like that's going to improve our foreign relations with other countries. Having said that, Obama hasn't done as well by placing troops in Australia and Africa and is expanding the Predator drone. So both presidents have to work on being, you know, use more velvet glove than an iron gauntlet if they're going to improve their foreign policy.
Bill, your thoughts?
Well, I would agree that, you know, we just can't go through military might alone. Number one, we probably just don't have the money anymore, and we've been stretched thin on a number of fronts. So I think Republicans are going to have a little bit more nuance in the way they talk about national security in this campaign. And as I said at the outset, I just don't think President Obama has given them much room to go out there. You know, if you think about any presidential campaign, you put down markers, and candidates have to do that. Some markers matter more than others. In this race, again, I don't think the foreign policy marker is going to matter as much. We should pay attention to it because, as you remember, when nation building came up in 2000, the debate between Bush and Gore, probably most of us thought that was a little bit of a yawner and why are we talking about that? And later that became a big issue. So, yes, we should pay attention to what Romney says, but I just don't think this is the marker that really is going to matter.
Molly, very quickly, what are your thoughts on the subject?
Well, you do hear this very interesting new attack on the president from the Republicans, blaming him for the defense cuts in the sequester legislation, which, of course, is the trigger that Congress created to try to force them to do something about the budget, and it didn't work. This was a bipartisan thing that was built in there, and now you have Republicans trying to make these Obama's defense cuts and accuse him of trying to weaken the military. So it'll be interesting to see if that actually sells.
This is On Point. I'm Wade Goodwin in for Tom Ashbrook. In other news this week, riots broke out in Anaheim, California, after police officers shot and killed Manuel Diaz. His mother, Genevieve Huzar, condemned the rioters, but she blamed the police for her son's death.
He was shot first in the back, and then when he was down, then they shot him the second time. They shot him in the head.
Sally Ride lost her battle with cancer at the age of 61. The first American woman in space blasted off on June 18, 1983.
And liftoff of STS-7 and America's first woman astronaut. And the shuttle has pulled the tower.
Actor Sherman Hemsley, famous for his role as George Jefferson on TV's The Jeffersons, died at 74.
Well, we're moving on.
We're talking with Bill McKenzie, Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist for the Dallas Morning News, Molly Ball, political reporter from The Atlantic, and with our own Jack Beattie. In an interview with CBS this morning on Tuesday, NCAA President Mark Emmert explained why he rejected simply canceling the Penn State football program in the wake of the child sex abuse scandal.
The reason that I and the executive committee decided not to impose the death penalty was that it was too blunt an instrument. It affects too many people that had utterly nothing to do with these affairs. The marching band didn't have anything to do with this. The mom and pop that's running a hot dog stand in the town didn't have anything to do with this. The rest of the institution probably had nothing to do with this. We're trying to focus the penalties where they're most likely to change the culture.
Bill, you are in Dallas. You saw up close and personal what can happen when a university gets the death penalty. SMU really still is just now coming back strong from their death penalty in 86. What did you think of the Penn State penalties?
Well, you're right. SMU has only kind of emerged from that in the last 3 to 4 years. I think the NCAA hit the mark. I think they were tough, and I think they're right to avoid the death penalty. Their ban on scholarships, a ban on bowl games, fines, all that, that's really serious, and I don't think we should diminish that. I think they're right not to do the death penalty because in SMU's case, SMU, A, was on probation for a period of time leading up to when they got hit with the death penalty, and they continued to violate the probation, and they were paying players, and that is what got them in trouble, and I think the difference is SMU was seeking a competitive advantage on the field through what it was doing, as well as its cover-up. I guess I just don't see Penn State's situation similarly. I don't see Penn – certainly not what Jerry Sandusky was doing, was seeking a competitive advantage on the field. I guess maybe you could argue that's what the cover-up was about in Penn State, but I just think there's a fundamental difference between what was happening at SMU and what was happening at Penn State. So I think this is the right call.
Molly, the NCAA didn't wait around. They used the free report, and instead of a year's investigation, they came down on Penn State's head very quickly.
Yeah, and they're obviously under a lot of pressure to act here and to show that they're being proactive, even though I think there's a widespread feeling that anything they could do, no matter how severe, would be sort of too little too late, considering the sort of tragedy of what occurred there. But, Bill's right. In a situation where there was obviously systemic abuse that pervaded the administration, you have to find a way to root that out without then punishing people who had nothing to do with it or impacting the students who deserve to have a way to move forward.
Arthur is calling from Corbin, Kentucky. Arthur, hello.
Hello, everyone. I'm kind of like at odds with the NAACP right now because to take these wins away from these students, these students have fought hard for those victories, and they deserve to keep their titles. But I believe that Sandusky, this one individual that said he witnessed an assault, anyone on staff or on faculty who may have known something about this, every single one of these individuals ought to be heavily fined. Sandusky ought to be imprisoned. But to punish the students by taking their wins away, that's just a slap in the face to the students as far as I'm concerned.
I saw some tweets from some of Joe Pa's players who'd had great years in the last decade, being dismayed that suddenly they hadn't won a single game during their entire career, much to their surprise. Jack Beattie, the Penn State faithful are stunned. I think they're stunned at what has happened, and they're stunned that their football program is about to take a big turn into a new world. They're not going to be the same Penn State they were for quite a long time. How did you feel about the Penn State sanctions?
Well, I agree with what's been said with Bill and Molly that it struck me as a very hard but fair penalty, and I especially liked, was it $60 million? Was that the fine? Mm-hmm. And that's going to be spent on programs for helping people who, victims of abuse and so on. That seems to be nothing but good. And also just this great publicity given this. I mean, you know, this issue, this kind of thing, has just been pushed under the rug until the last decade. And with each outrage, I just hope that that it acts as a deterrent to those who might be tempted to prey on children.
The NCAA certainly hasn't gotten a lot of good publicity lately, but I think the general consensus is that this is one they got right. In Colorado, here is ABC News reporter Dan Harris outside of a Colorado courtroom. He's recounting the odd demeanor of the Aurora massacre suspect James Holmes in the courtroom.
Even before this bizarre spectacle of James Holmes in court with that shock of orange hair and that face looking alternately bug-eyed, bored, or blasted, even before this, police sources tell ABC News that Holmes has been acting in an extremely strange manner ever since he was taken into custody, refusing to cooperate, acting as if he was unaffected by his arrest. And even when officers put evidence bags over his hands to preserve the gunpowder residue, pretending they were hand puppets.
Jack, the fact that the suspect, James Holmes, has been acting bizarrely in an extremely strange manner, I don't think it's going to come as much as a surprise to the American people.
Oh, my God, no. I mean, he defines bizarre. But the question for public policy isn't bizarre. There's no dealing with that kind of thing. The question is guns. And I think the New York Times has a very tough editorial today. Candidates cower on gun control. Mitt Romney, of course, who signed a bill in Massachusetts that would have made illegal the assault weapon that the assailant used in Aurora. He, of course, took a, well, it's the heart of man position. But the Times, I think, was right to say that President Obama's response was, quote, even more disappointing. Because talking to the Urban League, he talked about, you know, oh, we have to enhance background checks. But he said nothing about closing gun show loopholes or about the ease with which the mentally ill can get guns. And he said, oh, yes, AK-47s should be kept in the hands of soldiers, not criminals. Well, the Times points out, yes, and automatic weapons like AK-47s have been banned since 1934. The question is, semi-automatic rifles like the one used here and high-capacity clips, he said nothing about them, even though in the campaign he said he was going to reinstate the assault weapons ban.
Bill, I'll be honest with you. If I'm Barack Obama and I'm trying to win re-election and I'm looking at Florida and Virginia and North Carolina and Pennsylvania, I think I might continue to cower.
Well, sure, politically, that's not going to be going out to argue for reinstituting the assault weapon ban is probably not going to help you in some of those with some of those swing voters. But let me say, I'm in favor of the tougher gun control laws. I'm in favor of reinstituting the assault weapon ban. So that doesn't bother me. But what I really think this case is ultimately going to be about is mental health and how we deal with mental illness in our society. And I'm not trying to blame society for what James Holmes did, but a case like this does kind of bring back to our attention the need to pay attention to cues, whether it's in our families or with our schools or workplace, wherever it may be, to pay attention to people like this. And I'm not saying people didn't pay attention. You know, we may find out more that went on with the University of Colorado Medical School with Holmes. But I think this is ultimately a case about mental illness and mental health more than it is about weapons bans.
Bill is calling from Iowa City, Iowa. Bill, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks. I'm a retired Marine, and I've got an SKS and a shotgun. And we don't need to ban semi-automatic rifles, but we need to ban 100-round drums, make a 20-round clip maximum. Same thing happened to Gabby Gifford. You know, a 30-round clip in a Glock, you should never need more than a 10-round. And I think we can get that through.
Molly, you know, you see that in these shooting situations that people will wait until the shooter has to reload and then try to tackle them. Are clips the answer here?
Well, I think the caller's exactly right to point out that we've seen this whole movie before, right? That in tragedy after tragedy, there's an attempt to start a discussion about gun control, and it goes nowhere. You have, you know, both of the candidates right now, tiptoeing around the subject. The NRA is extremely powerful in Congress, and Democrats have made gains in the House and Senate in part by being successful in red states, by neutralizing the gun issue, being as pro-gun as the Republicans are, getting the NRA's endorsement in a lot of these districts. And so you just have a very small caucus in Washington, D.C., and in partisan politics in general for gun control. You have Mike Bloomberg and a couple of legislators, and that's basically it. The high-capacity clip issue is something that I believe Frank Lautenberg and Carolyn Maloney were working on in the wake of Tucson, and it went nowhere. They are trying to revive that in the wake of this incident and introduce some new proposals. Maybe I'm being cynical, but it is hard to imagine that any real progress gets made on that.
Let's turn to something a little more pleasant, the Olympics. Here's American swimmer and recent high school graduate Rachel Bootsma talking about her first Olympic race coming up this Saturday in London.
It's crazy. I mean, I remember dreaming about it for as long as I can remember, I guess. And now that it's finally real, I guess it still hasn't hit me, but it's an amazing accomplishment, and I couldn't be more proud to represent the United States.
Jack, are you looking forward to this?
You know, I am, and if I may, with tongue-in-cheek, say, you know, we're planning, I think it's August 4th, to set us up, whatever time it is. It could be 3 o'clock in the morning, but we're going to be there to cheer for Rafalka in the dressage competition. That's Ann Romney's horse, and I think it's incumbent upon Americans to get behind, you know, this popular sport, this plain man sport, and to give a cheer for Rafalka in dressage. So we're going to be doing our part.
I know I'm coming together with the rest of Americans. Molly, how about you?
Well, maybe this is just my bias as a political reporter. I'm just relieved that we get a little bit of a break from the campaign and a little bit of America coming together instead of all this squabbling that we have constantly with the presidential campaign.
Bill, do you have a favorite sport that you follow?
Well, I have two answers there. One, to look better in my children's eyes, I will be paying very close attention to swimming and diving. They're absolutely nuts over it, and they're really into this, and I think it is fascinating. The other one I always love is when the marathoners come into the stadium. I don't know what it's going to be like in London, but usually, you know, these folks are running, and they come through a tunnel, and then they go in the stadium. There's just this humongous roar. I think that is really awesome, and I think that would be fascinating to watch.
The Olympics seem pretty. The Olympics seem pretty free from political turmoil. I mean, I know they're not going to recognize the Israeli athletes that were killed in Munich, but I think other than that, we don't have anyone refusing to play ball with the Israelis or any other unhappy political problems. Jack?
Yeah, well, that's a change, isn't it? I guess we've had all our gaffes right at the beginning with Mitt Romney's comments, and it looks like it's going to be smooth sailing. Although, I would hate to be a Londoner during this period. From what I've read, they basically can't come out of their houses for traffic, and getting anywhere, forget about it. But I wish them all good luck.
Molly, we're going to have a fantasy competition. If you were in any sport and could participate in any sport in the Olympics, and, well, let's just be honest here, we're not going to win the gold. I'd say win the bronze. Look at us, right? What would it be?
Well, I am nobody's idea of an athlete, but my father is a former Olympic athlete. He actually was on the U.S. cycling team in those 72 Olympics in the team time trial. So I think as a tribute to my father, I have to say cycling.
And has he told you stories about what it was like for him?
Yes, absolutely. And fortunately, their competition, the cycling competition, occurred before the tragic events of 72. And he's told me if it had been afterwards, he doesn't know how he would have been able to focus on the competition. Obviously, it was tough for all of those athletes to go forward.
My goodness, growing up with a father who's an Olympian, what father can live up to that? Jack, how about you? What's your fantasy competition?
Well, you know, I've seen photographs and interviews with the American weightlifter, a woman who I think weighs 300 pounds. or something like that. And she just struck me as talk about a self-made person. And her mother said there's been no taming her since she was a child. She would always do the riskiest thing. She just went on and on. So I'm all for her because she stands, after all, it seems to me, for the entrepreneurial, venturesome spirit of our people.
Bill, how about you?
Hard to top these. Well, I guess I'd go back to those marathoners coming through the tunnel, and I would be dead last, I assure you. But if I were coming through the tunnel, I think that'd be great to see a roar. How about you, Wade?
Well, I just smoked Usain Bolt in the 100 meters, much to his shock, and then I get on the podium, I pull the Usain Lightning Bolt pose, and he gets furious and punches me clean off the podium, and an unseemly melee in the infield ensues that tarnishes an otherwise wonderful Olympics. The end. Bill McKenzie, columnist for the Dallas Morning News, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Molly Ball, political reporter at the Atlantic, thanks for joining us as well.
Thank you, Wade.
Jack Beatty, thanks to you also.
Okay, thank you.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Wade Goodwin, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.